Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and the art of healing, insomnia, sleep disorder, nervousness, agitation, anxiety, tremor, mania, confusion, dizziness, amnesia, low libido, apathy, central nervous system, depression or stimulation, hallucinations, paranoid reactions, psychosis. Sound like something you'd sign up for? Maybe not, but this is the short list of adverse reactions to antidepressants from clinical trials. And although millions are taking these drugs, few of these pharmaceuticals actually have been subjected to strictly controlled trials. Now they're being prescribed widely for children, which is considered an off-label use, meaning that they haven't been tested for use in children, and guess what? They're causing an increase in suicides in youth. But don't they work for some people? Studies show only 10% of trial participants improved over those taking a placebo. And this, when participants were screened and those who showed a sensitivity for placebos were eliminated from the study. I've never agreed with the use of antidepressants, but after reading Dr. Peter Bragan's book, The Antidepressant Factbook, I have more science to back up my objections. Join me in the next hour as I interview Dr. Peter Bragan. Before I introduce my guest, let me just remind you that we are in our sluggish spring fund drive, and we have yet to make our goal. So we're going to be begging you to send any amount of money to the station during this hour. Anything you can do, if you've already joined several times during the show, please dig deep and send us whatever change you have in your pocket. Help us get our goal so we can get off of this fund drive and move on to our wonderful programming. I will give you ample opportunities to call, but remember that during this hour, if you do call at 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732, you can get a copy of the Antidepressant Factbook by Peter Bragan as a gift. You're not buying the book. You're getting it as a gift at the $75 pledge level. If you want to pledge at the normal level of $60 a year, we can give you a 20% discount coupon off of a one-year subscription to Your Own Health and Fitness's Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine, a newsletter which will come to you six times a year. You'll get 20% off of a yearly subscription for a pledge to KPFA as a thank you gift, as a pledge. This will not be offered to anybody except during this pledge drive for KPFA listeners. So, and you can get both the book and the subscription discount coupon for $100. So I hope that some of you out there will consider maybe joining for a friend if you've already joined, or even just, as I said, sending whatever you can to help us through. Let me introduce my guest. Known as the conscience of psychiatry, Peter R. Bragan, MD, is the international director of the Center for Study of Psychiatry and Psychology and the author of dozens of scientific reports and books, including Talking Back to Prozac and Your Drug May Be Your Problem. His background includes Harvard College, a teaching fellowship at Harvard Medical School, and 2 years at the National Institute of Mental Health. This book draws on his more than 30 years of private practice in psychiatry and the most current scientific research. We are very lucky to have him, since he told me when I called him that he's not doing interviews anymore, but he loves Pacifica. Welcome to you, Dr. Peter Bragan. Sally, do we have Peter Bragan on the line?
Yep.
Oh, there you are.
Here I am, just to sit and wait.
Okay. Well, thank you again for making yourself available.
You're welcome.
I was just telling them that you don't do interviews anymore, but
very rarely,
coaxed you out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, in the 70s, you got involved, among other things, because of some very racist and inhuman psychosurgery practices that were being used on, among other people, young African-American children in institutions, and these and other forms of electrical and surgical interventions lobotomized patients and permanently damaged their brains. And I'm really struck by how these practices not only continue today, but how antidepressants and antipsychotic medicines also contribute to the destruction of the brains of innocents. I'd like you to comment.
Well, it's an extremely good point. And, you know, one of my medical books I named Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry. Historically, the biologically oriented part of psychiatry, which has always been the dominant part, has actually thrived on damaging the brain. And if you go back to the 1930s, I think that's the true revolution in psychiatry. And that revolution was changing from attacking the body itself to attacking the brain. So in the 1930s, you have electroshock treatment, which is still with us, lobotomy, which is still with us, although not common, shock is common, and insulin coma, which isn't around much anymore. And then you develop in the 1950s the very heavy-duty drugs like, you know, Haldol and nowadays Risperdal and Zyprexa and Seroquel. And all of them are very brain-damaging. They all produce drastic changes in the brain, and they cause a variety of neurological disorders. And now we're finding out that the newer ones also cause diabetes and pancreatitis. So we have a long history, and even stroke. Now Risperdal, I'm a medical expert in cases of the elderly where Risperdal has caused stroke. So we have a long history in psychiatry of damaging the brain as a way of treating patients. And I think that's because the damaged brain produces less problems for people.
Particularly doctors.
Well, particularly doctors and sometimes families and sometimes the patients themselves. I mean, you know, we voluntarily often damage our brains. You know, people drink to excess, take drugs that harm them, street drugs. Young people sniff glue and do other dreadful things to their brains. So human beings have struggled with the human condition since early times and have often resorted to self-destructive means. Now, the sad part about biological psychiatry and the tragic part is that it takes advantage of the human tendency to want to handle life's difficulties and our personal problems and our emotional crises and all the various the things that plague the spirit and the personality of ourselves, and to deal with that by providing a drug or a shock or even a lobotomy. And for people who just don't believe lobotomy is coming back, in fact, up in Vancouver, they've got a new center that's doing psychosurgery on the brain. And just a year or two ago, we won a big suit against the Cleveland Clinic, where they put electrodes in the brain of an elderly lady and ended up basically destroying her. And Cleveland Clinic got a verdict against it in court in this case where I testified for over $7 million. So these things, in their worst, are alive and well. But usually now we package them, in ways that we can advertise on television. You know, we imply that Paxil is going to correct the biochemical imbalance when there's no evidence of that at all, or that Prozac or Zoloft or one of these other drugs is going to correct the balance, when in fact the only biochemical balance that we know of in the brains of human beings who are suffering from psychiatric problems, the only biochemical imbalances that we know of are the ones induced by the psychiatric drugs, because they all cause serious biochemical imbalances.
It might be useful for people to hear how you come to the work, especially the fact that now you are a qualified expert and you go to court for people and testify in these cases. And that as a result of that, you've been privy to materials and files of some of the biggest pharma companies, and you've been able to bring this stuff out in court. I mean, you are a lone voice in the woods. I don't know what we're going to do if you stop doing what you're doing, because I don't think anybody else is up to speed like you are.
No one is doing the broad range that I am. One other gentleman who was doing some similar things is retired now, and another is a biological psychiatrist who just happens to focus on some of the antidepressants. It's very hard to be doing what I'm doing, because you have to take a great deal of flack from the drug companies and from other sources. But I've been, this is my 50th, if you can believe this, my 50th year of doing reform work. In 1954, I was a Harvard freshman, Harvard College freshman, and I volunteered to work in a state mental hospital. And I was so appalled by what I saw in the way of lobotomy and electroshock and insulin coma and just the dreadful abusive conditions that the patients lived under, that I gave up an honors program in American history and literature and went pre-medical in order to make a difference in the field of psychiatry. And I ended up running this giant volunteer program. We had a very good effect on the hospital. And when I went into psychiatry, to medical school, I was just going in to be a psychiatrist. At that point, there was a critical element in psychiatry. There were programs in social psychiatry and community psychiatry. Many psychiatrists were psychotherapists. But a drastic change occurred in the 70s when psychiatry could no longer compete with psychologists and social workers who got equal privileges for doing therapy. And many of these were women who were psychologists and social workers, and in California, marriage and family counselors and other non-medical people. And these women often were doing much better jobs with the than the men and were often much more sensitive to women's issues. And psychiatry was actually going broke. It was literally going broke because it just couldn't compete. And out of that came the decision by psychiatry to actually medicalize further, to claim that ultimately all human suffering is biologic and genetic, so that then they could still remain on top of the heap, so that they could see four or five patients an hour, give drug, give shock treatment, supervise the social workers and the psychologists and so on. And that was literally a political decision that I traced in toxic psychiatry, literally a political decision to act more medical and to take more money from the drug companies. And that unholy coalition between the drug companies, when I disclosed, and the Psychiatric Association, when I disclosed it in the New York Times, they wrote a letter to, back in the New York Times saying, well, it's a partnership. The American Psychiatric Association said, we have a partnership with the drug companies. And that partnership has had this profound effect on our culture and our society, and in which people now think that the answers lie in psychiatric drugs and antidepressants. And of course now we're finally getting confirmation of things that you can find in all of my books, including the antidepressant fact book, that actually antidepressants are probably doing more harm than good, and that they cause suicidal tendencies and violent tendencies.
So that we don't, because we only have about half an hour with you now, let's get right to...
I am free-ranging today.
No, you're fine. That's fine. Everything you're saying is very relevant. Let's get to the actual science here. There really isn't such a thing as an antidepressant. This is an inaccurate term. There really is no such thing. Can you explain?
Yes. If you actually look at controlled clinical trials comparing antidepressants to placebo, they're actually no better. The way the drugs get approved is the company does 20 trials and 17 of them fail and 18 fail, and in two they get some marginal success, and that's all the FDA requires, is this marginal success in two of the trials. But that's not science. If you failed 18 times and succeeded twice, that's not a proof of anything, obviously. And besides, these trials are only 4 to 6 weeks long usually, and on top of that, they're conducted by paid hacks for the drug companies. These investigators are well known to the drug company, handpicked. They've known them for years. They know they're going to try their best to give them good results, and they downplay the adverse effects of the drugs. I see this whenever I go inside the drug companies to look at their files in product liability cases against them. You just find great efforts to downplay the adverse effects of the drugs. So it turns out really that what you're looking at is a placebo effect with depression and antidepressants. And that's not a surprise, because depression is fundamentally hopelessness. It's a feeling of overwhelming hopelessness. And if a doctor gives you a medication that's supposedly going to help you, and during that period of time you get better spontaneously, or you get better because you have hope, then it looks to you like the drug has been helping. The drugs also can cause an irrational euphoria. They can cause even mania. very cocaine-like effects, the newer antidepressants. And so if you get that effect, you may think you're being helped, but it's often unrealistic and is not really helping you in the fine-tuning of life, such as relating to your husband or wife or children, or really, you know, carrying your job to a new and better level. Now, recently, within the last months, the FDA has actually come out and said that there's a strong possibility, and one of their internal people who was looked into it said it's a fact, that these drugs, the newer antidepressants, all of them basically cause suicidality. But they went a step further, and this has not been adequately covered in the news. They said that we, in addition to the suicide question, which we're still debating, we know, it is known, known is the word you'll find on the website, that these drugs cause irritability, agitation, anxiety, hostility, mania, and hypomania, and they've started to force the drug companies to put this in their label. Recently, Celexa came out and changed this label, and it includes now hostility, parentheses, aggression. And one of the things that I'm seeing that's the most tragic is, of all, and I get phone calls several a week on this, is people who commit horribly violent crimes while agitated in a cocaine-like way on these newer antidepressants. And we don't know what percentage of people get that disturbed, but we do know a very significant portion will get that agitation stimulant cocaine-like response. So these are very, very dangerous drugs, and we're finally getting the FDA to admit it. And that's something I've been working on now for 10 years, is trying to convince the profession about this.
Let me just remind people that you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone with Dr. Peter Bregin, B-R-E-G-G-I-N, M-D. He is, as I said, a lone voice in the woods. He's, for the last 50 years, as he just said, has been fighting to humanize psychiatry again and the medical profession, and has been fighting against psychosurgical techniques and now antidepressants, which it turns out really are drugs. They really are drugs, and they work like drugs, and they're not biochemical imbalances being fixed. And we are, of course, in a fun drive, but I'll get back to that in a moment. There's a way in which people are hypnotized into believing, as you said, there's a placebo effect. They're told that they have a biochemical problem, and it's explained, you know, the serotonin and the thing,
right,
and that. And they say it's like insulin for diabetes.
Right.
This is really insidious because, first of all, even insulin for diabetes is not a particularly accurate term there, because
that's
there's a
right.
lot of questions about that, too. But, you know, we are great believers in heroic medicine. We do intervention. And now what's happening that's really making it difficult, I mean, I see people in my office who are completely addicted and think, you know, they don't know if they're getting better or not. They're not sure, but it's very confusing. And, of course, what happens is that the doctor gives them more or another one or several at the same time. So one of the things that's really frightening about this picture is that the interactions of these medications together, mixing them, is extremely dangerous. You are just compounding the brain damage, which, as you point out in the book, in some cases is permanent.
Yes, we don't have good studies on the permanent damage from antidepressants, but we have some animal studies showing that recovery is never complete or is not fully complete in the young animals. And we know from other drugs that affect the same neurotransmitters, particularly serotonin, we know from studies of amphetamine and cocaine and methamphetamine, that the changes in the same systems, the serotonergic systems, can be long, long-lasting and even permanent. People often start out feeling more elated on the drugs, and that, you know, seems like a good thing to them. But in the long run, it's much more common to get a dulling and an apathy. And I can't tell you how sad I feel when people come up to me after one of my talks and will say to me, you know, these antidepressants have just helped me, they've saved my life, and they look so flat and sad.
Because yeah, I see the same thing.
You see that, isn't mm-hmm. it? It's so tragic. Mm-hmm. I mean, and certainly I don't want to, you know, just casually meeting someone to point that out to them, but so I don't. But it's a very sad phenomenon. The drugs, basically drugs don't help the brain. They end up eventually dulling the capacities of the brain, and in the process they may give you a sense of energy or elation because of a stimulant effect, but that is not going to be long-lasting, nor is that particularly healthy or realistic. And it's also tragic because depression, unlike a lot of other human problems, is one that spontaneously clears often, and that clears from just a variety of other alternatives. Everything from herbal remedies, which is, again, not something I push, but there's certainly...
Yeah, no, I don't push them either, because they're still drugs. The only thing that we discussed, and actually I realized that you cover it in the book, is that there are undiagnosed health problems that go undiagnosed.
Often.
So, you know, people come into my office, and it's like they're screaming thyroid disorder.
That's right.
Or they're screaming estrogen dominance or menopause. And the latest thing now is that all women are being taken off of their hormones. They can use bioidentical hormones. There's no evidence of cancer causing problems with very small dose bioidentical hormones that are balanced. And they're taken off their hormones and given antidepressants. And I see people with fibromyalgia, which is a situation where people probably don't even know what's wrong with this person. It could be Lyme disease. They haven't done the work. They haven't done the diagnostic work. Or thyroid disease. And they're taking antidepressants, and they're getting... Or they have body-wide pain, and they're given antidepressants for the pain. Mm-hmm. And what you point out in the book is it makes those problems worse. It creates more hormone imbalances, and it creates more body-wide pain-like problems and headaches and things.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the themes of the Antidepressant Fact Book is that we're so busy as psychiatrists and physicians chasing mythical biochemical imbalances in sad people or depressed people that we don't look to see if maybe what they actually have is some fatigue syndrome or disorder causing them to be tired and to feel like they just can't handle life, because nothing will make a vital human being depressed more quickly than an undiagnosed cause of their being tired or fatigued or slightly having the edge taken off their cognitive abilities. People crash very easily when they can't function the way they want to. And if they're then told it's a biochemical imbalance, well, sure, it feels like something's the matter with their body. So they easily buy it, not knowing that no such things have been demonstrated in an animal or a human being. It's a very sad affair.
And well, I think what confuses people is that if you have a hormone imbalance or you have a thyroid problem and somebody balances your hormones, you feel really different.
Oh, yeah.
So they think, oh, it is biochemical.
Right.
So, it's a tricky term, biochemical, but the body doesn't do anything for no reason. It doesn't do it for, oops, no. I mean, cancer, I suppose you could say, but even that, you know, who knows. But usually when the body creates a symptom, it's there for a reason, and depression is there for a reason. And if you don't address the reason, which is one of the things that you really push for in this book, is, geez, what happened to therapy? I mean, I'm a big advocate of therapy. Yeah, it really works.
Depression is a signal. It's a signal. But it's such a broad signal. It can be a signal that you have Lyme disease. It can be a signal that you have any number of disorders. For me, if I'm feeling a little depressed, it's often a signal I'm about to get a cold because I just hate anything that interferes with my energy level. Or it can be a signal that you haven't recovered from losing your husband or your wife, or your disappointment in your relations with your children, or you're realizing at age 40 that you're not doing the creative work you had hoped you were going to do, or at age 75 that that you're alone and need companionship. It's a signal, and to suppress the signal by dulling the brain or causing an artificial euphoria is not, to my mind, the appropriate therapy. And
I also don't see people get better until they get off the drugs. I don't see, see people who have these failure to thrive. You see it too.
Mm-hmm.
And I also know therapists who won't work with clients if they're on drugs.
Yeah.
They just can't work with them. There are some other things too that are new things that are showing up too, like cardiovascular problems precipitated by these drugs. I think one of the reasons that people get mystified into thinking that they must be doing better is that, as you point out in the book, it impairs their perception.
That's one of the very... I'm so glad you brought that up. One of the... By the way, it's such a pleasure to be on the radio with somebody who's actually thought as much or more about some of these things than I have.
Oh, that's such a compliment. Thank you.
I mean, but it really is a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much.
But... The You know, the media has gotten so under the influence of the drug companies that it's gotten to be a real difficult and a painful process usually to be talking to the media, the newspapers.
They're distorting everything. Yeah. It's getting very distorted
it's
out there.
It's getting extremely distorted. But now I got so interested in what you were saying that I forgot what your question was.
Impaired perception,
yep.
The fact that these drugs do that.
It's one of the very first things that happens in any brain dysfunction, whether you're developing Alzheimer's or whether you're very fatigued or have a virus or you're drinking alcohol. Anybody who's ever sat near people who are smoking dope and they think they're telling the funniest stories they've ever heard in their lives, and it's sheer gibberish to you because your brain's not impaired. And similarly, we used to have these ads on television, you know, friends don't let the drunk friends drive. Well, if you've ever tried to prevent a drunk friend from driving, you discover they think they can drive better than ever. And this kind of denial that comes out of impairment is typical of all drugs that disrupt the function of the brain, including all the antidepressants and the neuroleptics and the Ritalin we give our kids and so on. One of the highest human functions, and hence the first to go, is perception of self. And I've sat in my office with men telling me that their marriages are better than ever since they've been on Prozac, and the wife is practically in tears because she doesn't feel loved anymore by this man who has lost his passion. And doesn't even recognize it. So it's very hard to rely on self-judgment, but ironically, when you look at the studies for drug approval by the FDA, the patient's self-rating scales nonetheless almost never indicate that the drugs have helped. It's always the psychiatrist's subjective rating that pushes the drug over into looking like it's useful.
I think it would be helpful for people if you could explain, like maybe even just using the serotonin reuptake as a model. Explain why this is a flawed concept. Explain what happens when you when you interfere with the normal way that the brain recirculates things. What exactly goes on and why that's so damaging? Because this is an audience that's used to hearing science.
Well, we can start in the beginning and say, well, why in the world would serotonin even matter when it comes to depression? The only reason it matters is because the drug company Eli Lilly developed a drug Prozac that affected serotonin and immediately paid doctors, even before the drug was approved, to go around the country and try to say that serotonin was related to depression. But in fact, there are probably 200 neurotransmitter systems in the brain, and we've only explored in any depth, and that's a really tiny depth, like, you know, toe-level depth. We've only explored 6 or 8 of them, which are the ones that are related to psychiatric drugs, so there's money there to explore them. So we're looking at one neurotransmitter out of hundreds, and then in addition to the neurotransmitters, there's various hormones that are going. Oh, and by the way, each neurotransmitter may have dozens of subtypes, so you're looking at an infinitely complex system in which you have just intervened and poured a toxin into it that affects one portion of that system. To assume that's going to be an improvement is ridiculous. If you took your computer in because it had a bad program and the guy started pouring various substances into your computer because the program wasn't working, I mean, you'd think that the guy was nuts and you'd take your computer back right away. You'd want a more rational explanation than that. So we're doing something to our brain that we wouldn't let a mechanic do to our computer or to our automobile. Now, what we do know and have learned is that when you give a drug that's the so-called SSRIs, these serotonin reuptake inhibitors, to the brain, they are supposed to interfere with the removal of the neurotransmitter serotonin from the synapse of the brain, from the connection. In other words, it's like blocking the removal of gasoline from a place in the spark plug, you know, right at the spark plug where it's supposed to fire off the system. Except that in this case, it's one of hundreds and hundreds of different systems that are at work in the brain that you're interfering with. Now, as soon as the brain senses that the removal process of getting rid of serotonin has been blocked or stifled, it goes into several compensatory phases. It tries to shut down producing serotonin so it won't be, the engine won't get flooded. The receptors for serotonin literally begin to die back, and that's one of the areas where permanency can happen, where the receptors don't recover. Some long-term studies have shown receptors aren't recovering. There's at least three different methods that we know of whereby the brain fights the removal of serotonin from the brain. Fights the flooding of the brain with serotonin. And if you give serotonin to an animal and then cut up its brain, I'm sorry, I'm talking too fast. If you give Prozac to an animal and cut up its brain, you're not going to find that there's more serotonin than before. You're not going to find that kind of gross change, but you will find changes in the mechanisms as the brain is fighting against the Prozac effect.
And it is fighting.
It's fighting.
Yeah, it's fighting back.
And I describe this and document this in detail in the antidepressant fact book. We have the science there for this. So you're basically putting the brain in an unstable condition in regard to serotonin when you block its removal from the synapses, and you don't know what the end product of that is. And as a result, you get these drug company flacks arguing it both ways, that some of them argue that the reason it works is because of the compensatory mechanisms, and others are saying it works because of the initial impact. And in fact, it doesn't work at all, in my opinion. It's just causing a disruption in the brain. And sometimes people will report and feel that a disruption is an improvement, but it is a disruption.
We need to take a brief musical break, maybe a minute or so, and we're going to also make it available for people to call into the station during this little brief musical break and get a copy of the antidepressant fact book by our guest Peter Bragan for a subscription level of $75. We're really giving it to you as a thank you gift for subscribing. The number to call is 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732. $75 gets you the antidepressant fact book as a thank you gift. Or for $60, you can get 20% off a year's subscription to the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine, which is the Your Own Health and Fitness newsletter. You will get 20% off with this coupon for a year subscription, and that's a $60 pledge. Or you can combine these two for $100. So, again, 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732. I'm Lena Berman on the phone with Peter Bragan. I'm going to give you some music. Please join us. Just want to encourage people to call in now during this little mini break to pledge at 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732 because our lines usually jam up a little bit at the end. Remember again that we are in our spring fund drive, and one possibility is you can get a copy of the antidepressant fact book as a gift because I know there are people in my family I'm going to get it for. And you may have people that you care about. And it is remarkable. I think I really believe that anyone reading this book will have a different feeling about antidepressants and may come around. It's very important information. It's being blocked in the media.
Lena, it's Sally, and the lines are lighting up.
Okay, let's keep going here. You can also get a 20% off of a one-year subscription to the Your Own Health and Fitness newsletter, which is called Progressive Health Observer. It's a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine. And in fact, in this first issue, we have a big spread on antidepressants and their dangers. And we quote from Peter Bragan's antidepressant fact book, and we also some other sources. And we talk about children in the article. It's a 20% off coupon for a $60 pledge. You pledge to KPFA, you join at the normal level of $60, and we gift you 20% off of the newsletter for the year. This won't be offered any other way. Only people at KPFA, only listeners will get a crack at getting a discount on this. You can get both of these for $100. Please join us now. It's 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732. And we'll get back to our interview with Peter Bragan in just a moment. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I am on the phone with Dr. Peter Bragan, B-R-E-G-G-I-N, M-D. He is our hero, and should be yours as well. He's, as I said, the lone voice in the woods for the last 50 years, fighting against inhumane practices in psychiatry, psychosurgery, electroshock therapy, lobotomies, and now antidepressants, which are a chemical lobotomy. And if you missed part of today's show or want to get a copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can always call. My information number is 707-874-2772. And, Dr. Bragan, you have a website.
Yes, it's very simple. It's Bragan.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com. And it has on it my latest peer-reviewed journal article, which reviews all the science behind the adverse mental reactions caused by the antidepressants, including violence and suicide and mania. And it also has many other of my scientific articles, references to my books. And it also links you to the FDA so that you can see how the FDA has finally come around to basically confirming what was originally 1994 in my book, Talking Back to Prozac, and which I've elaborated in the later books and studies.
Gee, I'm shocked, actually. Well, I would be remiss if I let you off the air without talking about addiction, soft addiction, and withdrawal, mostly withdrawal, because it's really bad for people to try to get off of these drugs, very bad.
The antidepressants all cause withdrawal reactions. The brain, it's the process of the brain fighting back that I talked to you about earlier, and when the brain fights back, it's trying to create a new balance with the drugs to counteract the drug. You then remove the drug and you have the compensated brain without the drug, and that's what withdrawal is. And I have had patients and read about patients who have had terrible difficulties stopping the newer antidepressants. The worst offender of all is Paxil, and or paroxetine, because it's short-acting and has a greater punch than some of the others. And recently I was the medical expert in a lawsuit in California that was finally resolved simultaneously with the drug company GlaxoSmithKline putting a warning in its label that you do get withdrawal reactions. And these reactions can include agitation and anxiety. And if you take a person who's particularly somebody who's already struggling with feelings of suicidality or feelings of violence and anger, and you put them through either a direct effect, toxic effect of these drugs, or the withdrawal effect, and you cause anxiety, irritability, hostility, that can lead to terrible actions, suicidal or violent actions. And right now I'm a medical expert in several suits where these drugs, either as a direct result or from withdrawal, have resulted in very severe reactions.
Well, you had one case against Kaiser where a woman developed very serious kidney disease, and you guys won, which really blows me away that you
won.
Well,
the one suit I'm thinking of is one in which was involved lithium.
Yes.
Involved Kaiser.
Yes.
And that
yes.
was the one case that I was involved in that I know of was actually not in California. And I think there was another one years ago in California as well. So you may be referring to a different one than I have.
No,
on my
the
mind.
Lithium one. And but, you know, it brings up another issue, too, which is that one of the things that kind of fuels all of this is this preponderance of diagnoses. You know, now we have new diagnoses. We
That's
have
right.
ADD. We have ADHD. You know,
right.
I mean,
and these diagnoses, people will think this is too cynical, but actually the diagnoses are often created to sell the drugs.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. That's
yeah,
exactly
absolutely.
What I'm saying. Oh, absolutely. What do you mean hyperactivity? I mean, kids are hyperactive. Yeah. That's a healthy kid.
Panic disorder was literally created by the Upjohn company to sell Xanax for a new disorder. And I've seen correspondence where one drug company is complaining about another drug company trying to get a drug approved for the disease they invented themselves. You know, so Company A says, "We invented this disease. You can't try to market a drug for it." It gets to be just bizarre. And
well,
ADHD,
you
see, what happened with ADD was when 90% of the people getting it were boys, so the kids getting it were boys because it had to do with hyperactivity, and boys, of course, are far more likely to get hyperactive, that is to feel restrained, constrained, and want to do more than other people want them to do, and want to jump around and be active. When they weren't getting enough girls, when marketing the drug to girls was not, and their parents wasn't proving good, they then moved into the inattention phase.
Mm-hmm.
So that if the girl's daydreaming, looking out the window, imagining poetry.
God, I hope so. I mean, the schools are so deadly boring to
That's
children.
Right.
But not only that, but, you know, the schools are also often very polluted. I mean, there's pesticides in the grass. There's often mold in the classrooms,
mm-hmm.
really serious mold. And mm-hmm. I've seen children being treated for allergies for mold become, like, autistic when they have a positive reaction to mold. I mean, they get all kinds of bizarre reactions. So, I mean, I just have never felt that. I mean, I think sometimes kids are getting allergic or they're getting toxic reactions.
Right.
Again, there might be a health problem, but they don't need their brains to be lobotomized by a chemical.
Well, and in my practice, the single most common thing that I see in kids who really do have a problem is that they're simply undisciplined. Parents nowadays are often, both parents are working. The children are being disciplined by babysitters or nobody at all. And also often the parents are at odds about how strict to be, and so one parent wants to be stricter and the other parent wants to be more permissive, and so the child gets mixed signals. And a lot of very out of control children I've been able to help in just a few weeks of working with the parents on consistent discipline.
Yeah, although discipline can go awry. I had a case of a woman bringing her daughter in who was about 20 and who seemed unfocused and not ambitious, mm-hmm. and they were worried about her, and there were two parents that are split up and they had joint custody, and she brought her in because her husband wanted to put her on an antipsychotic. And the reason was because she was traveling in Latin America. And she had an ecstatic experience. I mean, she was excited and happy, and she felt she was free. She was on her own, and she started to feel like she knew what she wanted and all this kind of stuff. Called her parents and was all happy and excited, and it was uncharacteristic, and they thought she was psychotic or that she was doing drugs. So when she got back, the father said, unless you take the antipsychotic, you will take an antipsychotic until you enroll in school, until you're
–
And I said, please don't do this. For one thing, the girl was very clearly insulin resistant, according to her hormone profiles, and she was eating starches and sugars. And I said, really, don't do this. There's nothing wrong with her, and we have to watch out for, you know, and they did it. They put her on it. The mother objected. Of course, the father did it. And I talked to her 3 months later. She had gained 30 pounds in 3 months.
Prexa.
Yeah, something like that. She went from being slender to being overweight,
obese,
and so it was completely out of control. And he said he was going to keep her on it until she got through the beginning of the school year.
Yeah,
and she won't be able to get off of it. And she's going to have she's going to be diabetic here. You know.
Yep. I actually have seen patients now who have died of diabetic crises on Zyprexa. Very very severe diabetic reactions to these drugs. They're toxic to the islands of Langerhans. They're toxic to the insulin-producing areas.
What about people who are having psychotic experiences? I mean, I know that you believe very strongly in therapy, and I can tell from your book that you are, although you started talking about discipline here, that you are extraordinarily compassionate, generous person.
See that, you know, there's not a contradiction between discipline and compassion.
That.
In fact, the most compassionate things we can do for our children is to give them some rules
and
make rational sense.
Yeah, to create some boundaries because the world has boundaries.
And,
but
they need them to internalize them to grow. I think it's
they need things to be clear. A lot of times things are not clear.
And not mean.
Yeah, not mean. Not mean.
Yeah.
But what about psychotic episode type
stuff? Well, I view psychosis as a loss of touch with human reality. That is a loss of touch with other human beings, so that you retreat into a desperately lonely, remote, and nightmare, and potentially nightmarish condition. And the way out of that is to remake relationships with human beings so that people who are psychotic in that sense of being really withdrawn from the reality of human relationships, they, above all other things, need warm, caring, intuitive relationships in which they can reconnect to at least one other person. And I view the role of the therapist as twofold. First, to provide a human being who can draw somebody back into reality, and two, to help the whole family surround the patient in a way that makes clear that this is a family, especially if it's a young person, that this is a family issue of all the family members learning to relate better to each other in a more caring and loving fashion, and a less desperate and angry fashion. And that, to me, that's the approach I've had now for over 30 years in practice. I do not give antipsychotic drugs to people who are hallucinating. I talk to them and relate to them. And almost most of the time, you can help a human being calm down and get back on track, mm-hmm. and do so better than the drugs, because all the drugs mm-hmm. do is they cause lobotomies. One of these drugs disrupts frontal lobe function, so the person is less imaginative and duller.
Yes, and there's also just the undiagnosed medical problems, too, with psychotics. And in some cases, I know this is not your favorite topic, but nutrient deficiencies, and I'm not talking about using nutrients pharmacologically, but just replacing things that might be missing if the diet is poor and things like that. I reluctantly have to let you go. I do know, incidentally, therapists who have told me that they have had successes treating psychotic individuals with therapy. So
routine 20 years ago before the profession medicalized. And I was working as a college student. See, I started in psychiatry working on the back wards of a state mental hospital as a freshman and sophomore at Harvard College. We got 15 patients of our own eventually. I write about this in Toxic Psychiatry. We ended up getting almost all of them out of the hospital, and we were untrained. We just had supervision in a group from a social worker.
Yeah.
I mean, the more disturbed you are, from my viewpoint, the more you should be protected from drugs, electroshock, and lobotomy, and the more you need a caring environment. I wish we had overnight retreats and hospitals where people could go to be protected rather than assaulted.
That's right. Well, good on you. What can I say? I mean, thank you for your work.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
You're such a gift. Thank you so much for your work and for participating today.
Thank you.
Dr. Peter Bragan, MD, his book is The Antidepressant Factbook. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want a CD copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772, or you can reach Jeff Fawcett, editor of the Progressive Health Observer and health educator, at 707-874-1496. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, transcripts, or the Progressive Health Observer, go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.org, where you can listen to this week's show all week, along with usually an archive that's up there for a few weeks. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.